It's a dungeon crawling romance game.
I don't care about that. What I cared about was when you said, you go in, you find weapons.
And then you date them.
Scotch.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 124 of Coffee with Butterscotch, the game dev comedy podcast, Butterscotch Shenanigans. I'm Seth, and I'm the games programmer.
I'm Adam, and I'm the deployer of web servers.
I'm Sam, and I make art sometimes.
And this is a show where we talk about live business and working in the games industry. Today is November 13, 2017. Before we start, we have a warning. Anything can happen on this show. There will be profanity, and there's going to be lewdness. So if you are a child or under the age of 62, you should not be listening to this podcast. Also, I have a question, brothers. The medicine bottles, all of them, they say things like...
The medicine bottles.
They say things like, for adults and children over the age of 12 or should whatever, yeah, they're always right. Like, yeah. That's the dosage.
For a man-sized child, basically.
Why can't they just say people over the age of 12? What's with the adults and children sort of combo phrasing here? Do you know what I'm saying? Is there a
That's
reason?
A good question.
Is there a reason? Think about it.
Because right. They're both people is what you're saying.
They're just people and over the age of 12.
And if you're giving the age, you don't need to split it into two other age groups.
Right. But don't they actually, though? Because I thought they have adults and they give a dose. And they say children over the age of 12 and they give another dose.
No, so. It's always adults and children over the age of 12.
Really?
It's like, yeah, two ibuprofen or something. Mm-hmm. And then... Children under the age of 12, one.
Is it?
And it's never about size. It's just about whether.
That's because it's completely whack. Did you know they actually use, and I'm not even making this up, for certain dosages, for certain kinds of drugs, they use surface area of your body.
That could make sense.
To calculate
sense.
The dose.
How do you measure that?
Mostly by BMI and then bullshit, but. But isn't that whack that they're like, how much skin do you have?
I feel like that's a good one, though. Especially if you got a cream.
Yeah,
you know?
if it's a lotion-based
well, yeah, medicine.
No, but these are ones that are you're ingesting still, you know?
Is it because of the blood vessel surface area goes up?
Yeah, but that only accounts for your skin, because you're a volume.
Right.
You know?
Right.
And there's this really convenient metric we have for volume, which is called your weight. Which is also really easy because it's a
well,
fucking
no,
single
because
number. You just stand on a thing and it's like, yeah, this is how much of
what have you got those
volume
heavy bones?
You've got.
You know?
Well, yeah,
that is true.
Because yeah, if somebody who weighs 240 pounds may be Dwayne Johnson,
The Rock.
He's got a low volume to weight ratio, right? Because he's a rock.
Yeah.
Right. So I don't know if weight is a good metric. What we should do is we should just throw people into bathtubs, see how much water they displace. You know. Then figure that.
That would make visits to the doctor just so much better, you know?
Just hop into a nice bath, but light some candles.
Take a dip.
Yeah, because actually density probably is more effective because you get kind of a rough sense. Because you know how dense like bones are, you know how dense muscles are, you know how dense fat is.
Right.
And then just regular guts. And also you kind of know how many guts a person has.
How many? You got like eight.
Yeah. And they're all kind of the same size, I think.
I got a question. Because there's air in there, right?
I mean, only in your lungs, but yeah.
Well, there's air in your torso and stuff. No. It's a vacuum?
It's a vacuum.
I don't believe that.
Not your vacuum. Not your, your inside your intestines. There's some air in there sometimes.
But like in your torso? Though. In your abdomen? It's just like a perfect.
Yeah. Yeah. There's no air pockets in there.
Oh. But it's like, so you had surgery, you got opened up. So now there's definitely air in there.
Well, they had to blow air into it.
Right.
But is there any left? Is it still in
Well,
there?
It goes away over time. So because air actually gets absorbed back into your bloodstream over time. If it's inside of you.
But doesn't that
so
mean
your
also,
blood is vacuum sealing your guts.
Yeah.
Doesn't that mean also that the blood is letting some air into your
I mean, it is through
hole?
Oxygen exchange, but it's letting it through as individual molecules, not as a gas.
I'm just saying, if you cut someone open, does it smell gross?
It depends on what part you cut open. If you cut
that's
open,
what I'm worried about.
If you cut open their intestines, yes. That smells real bad.
Like a candle that's scented like the inside of a man.
Yeah.
But just his, like, not his insides, like his guts, but just like the vacancy of a man.
The vacuum.
That would not be a
the
great.
The vacuum of a man.
That would not be a great business model.
By just sell those vacancy. Candles.
All right, let's get on to some studio news. We only have a couple things. So one is
we're going to start selling vacuum of a man scent.
Vacuum of a man scent.
We're going to be adding that to the merch store, which you can get those at store.bscotch.net or shop. Shit, which
shop.bscotch.net.
Shop.bscotch.net.
Mm-hmm. I feel like you got confused about that last week, and now it's just one of those stuff.
Can't get off
there's
of it
some
now.
Of those that happened to me. Like, if you can't remember a spelling, but you remember both of them, and then you can never give proper weight to the correct one. And they're just
especially
stuck.
All that I before E bullshit, yep. Except in certain circumstances thing.
Except basically all the time.
Yeah, because then every time I write a word, I'm like, I before E, except a bunch of circumstances.
It's especially a problem if you have a weird friend who you need to talk about a lot in writing, you know.
Yep. Especially if that weird friend is weird in part because they're so wired all the time.
Mm-hmm. The weird wired friend.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Gets real.
Who's a fiend.
Who's also a fiend. Which way does fiend go? Is it just like
friend without the R? Right. Yeah.
That's one of those classic I before E words.
Friend. Yes. So we talked last week about the iPhone X and how super pumped we were about the opportunity to rebuild Crashlands to accommodate the lack of corners, the notch, and the home bar.
Mm-hmm. We did it last week. Took like 2 days or so.
Took a couple days of jamming real hard to get all that stuff going. And we also started switching Crashlands over to Game Maker Studio 2. Mm-hmm. We've been in Game Maker 1.4 for quite a while. And so this is one of those tech debt things that we unfortunately were not able to plan for, where we had built the game in a certain tool, and now all of a sudden that tool is going to be deprecated like end of next year or something. And so we need to switch over to the new one, and it just is a process, and also we don't necessarily know what kinds of new issues that might introduce. So we thought, well, we're doing the iPhone X beta. We should just go ahead and make this switch while we got beta testers.
Well, for our Linux testing, we were already testing the Game Maker 2 version also. So we'd already kind of worked out a bunch of the kinks, and so it actually looks like it's in a pretty good spot.
It's in pretty good shape. Just one weird thing where when people would try to place floor tiles, they would instead punch holes through the earth, which
could be a feature.
It happens to me sometimes. trying to lay some hardwood and just...
Just boom. Infinite
all
hole.
The way to the core
it's
of
sort
the
of
earth.
Like the nothing, you know? Yeah. You're trying to make stuff and instead there's just nothing.
Yep.
So I think we got that bug fixed. So by the time the podcast hits, you know, it'll be in the clear. But if you want to get involved in the iPhone X beta.
We do need some iPhone X people.
Yes. Or even just the iOS beta in general, because we've actually seen some really good stability improvements for the game. It's just running a lot smoother, a lot better frame rates and stuff, aside from punching
holes
through the world. Whether or not you have an iPhone. Actually, especially if you don't have an iPhone X.
Correct.
Because the lower end iOS devices should see some pretty good performance boosts. So if you want to get in on that, feel free to, you can just hop into our Discord server, which is at discord.gg/bscotch. Mm-hmm. And you can just ask in there about how to get into the iOS beta.
You'll just see a channel called iOS, though, so it'll be just go there and talk.
Go in there. I'm sure there's a pin or an out. I don't know.
Who knows?
There's information.
But we also will be continuing to work on our Linux one, which we did a beta for a few weeks ago now. We ran into some bugs that we're still dealing with, but we'll soon need to kind of test the final resolution of this. So if that's something you're interested in too, just go ahead and get in there so that you're ready for that when we're ready.
Yeah. One bug that I'm really excited about having been fixed for the Linux is that the mouse wheel now works.
Yes.
So that's pretty good.
That's rough.
Well, that was really the main one. Cause that was the thing we had no workaround for.
Yeah. We can't just make it work.
Yeah. There was no way to make it work. The other ones we have workarounds for if we have to deploy them, even if our engine doesn't. This is a good time to talk about dependency on third parties, because what we're talking about here is the fact that our third party product that we use, our game engine from Game Maker, I guess from Yo-Yo Games, we're just dependent on them. So if they don't do something, if they have a bug that we can't work around, or if they decide to go to a new version and then leave a legacy version behind, that's all stuff we have to deal with. Mm-hmm. A lot of people we talk to, this is their rationale for making their own game engines. I just want to say, if you make your own game engine, this also happens, except now you're responsible for fixing it.
Yeah, you got work to do instead of being like, I'll continue to work on my game. And then when that bug is fixed, then it'll just be fixed now. Now you just don't work on your game for a while.
It's also just a problem with any engine. So, I mean, this has been the case in the Unity community for a long time.
Yep.
Even as big as Unity is and as powerful as that company is, I think there's been some suite of 2D related features that have been talked about for like 4 years or something, but still haven't managed to squeeze in to the builds yet. So everyone's a little frustrated with that.
But yeah, and I mean, making a framework like that is really hard. It's hard. You know, and the fact is, it's, I think the analogy is, you know, it's like you're building a castle on quicksand, right? Mm-hmm. Because what makes these engines useful and popular is that you can deploy to all kinds of different things, right? And so, like, we talked to, the Don't Starve crew. Mm-hmm. We know that every time they want to bring Don't Starve to a new platform, right, they have to rebuild the game, mm-hmm. right? Which is why, you know, they launched it on PC first.
Well, that's what happens if you make your own engine.
If you make your own engine, yeah. So, like, when they wanted to bring it to Android, they couldn't just go, oh, we'll just, like, go to
check a box.
We'll just go to the drop-down menu that says Android, and now it's on Android. They had to just remake the game, which is, that's the fun times you get to have when you make your own engine.
Same thing with when people request multiplayer from us. That's the sort of, even though we're in an engine, that's the sort of scaled project that would require that we just rebuild the game.
Just rebuild the
100%.
game.
100%. So, and so sometimes new form factors, like going to iPhone X, for example, you have to rebuild parts of it. Yep. And then new platforms, you just got to, like, we got to burn it down, start all over again.
Yeah. And so a lot of what these companies like Unity or Yo-Yo Games or Unreal, you know, what they have to deal with, or I guess Epic, mm-hmm. what they have to deal with their engines is that all these other companies, console makers, OSs, you know, Steam, whatever, they're constantly
taking the corners off of their screens.
Yeah. They're constantly changing the specs for things to seek improvements. Oftentimes they're just kind of arbitrary changes, but they're still changes that then those engine makers need to accommodate. Mm-hmm. And so it's just not easy. And it's something that we are happy that we don't have to do ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Even if occasionally there are some headaches.
Yeah, but it does mean that we have to wait for fixes, but at least we don't have to do anything. So, yeah, if you're planning on making your own engine, still don't.
Still not a good move.
Just don't. All right, let's get on to some questions. These questions come from our listeners over at podcast.bscotch.net. So if you'd like to get your question on a future episode, head over there, put some crap in the text box, and click submit. First question comes from Monstrodamus, which is awesome.
Monstrodamus, I believe.
Monster Adam US. Mm-hmm. What do you think about alphas and betas in general? And are you planning to invite players to an alpha or beta for your next game? Thanks.
They are fantastic.
And strictly required.
Well, so I want to talk about this. So there's this idea called the curse of knowledge. This comes from that Made to Stick book that I've been reading. And the curse of knowledge is basically that the closer you are to a thing, the less ability you have to see that thing for what someone who has no brush with it, no knowledge of it, actually sees it for. So in the case of an alpha, for example, you might come in and you're like, this game kicks so much ass. It's so readable, so easy to understand. And then you give it to someone and guaranteed, just not the case. As good as you think your game is, as soon as you show it to someone, it just turns into a flaming dumpster pile. And I think there's just it's a good exercise to do regularly because you learn a bunch of stuff, but then also because it kind of keeps your understanding of where players actually are and where you need to be a little more fresh in your mind when you see more people with it.
Yes.
That also means, though, that you can't continuously turn towards the same people.
Correct.
For your alpha. Or your alphas.
Because you're just passing on that curse.
Yep.
And
you gotta get fresh meat each time.
Fresh sacrifices.
Yeah. And show your game to people who you don't think would like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. This is something that there's a great scene in the show Silicon Valley where these group of engineers, they started up their product and they sent it out to all their friends to test it, who are all computer hardware engineers or software engineers in Silicon Valley. They sent them their product and everybody's like, this is fucking awesome. This is so good. Like, I totally get it. Mm-hmm. And then there was one person in their beta who hated it, just absolutely hated the thing that they made. And this was the one person who was also not a software engineer. So, and they're like, well, you know, that, like, they just don't know what the fuck they're talking about. So then they deployed it and none of their customers understood what the fuck this thing was. Mm. Right. And so I think it's easy to go into an alpha or a beta and like hand the game already to people who you're pretty confident would just like it. Cause then you're going to get that pat on the back and people are going to be like, oh, you made a great thing. You should be nervous if you only get positive feedback.
Yeah.
During those early stages of development.
Yeah. It is also tricky though, because the people who are in the best position to give you useful feedback that'll help you make the game better and more understandable to the people who it's going to be for are also the very people who are going to be the least good at giving you feedback.
Yep.
Because what makes them so good at understanding what an average player is going to experience is that they're an average player, right?
If they have no idea why, or maybe they have like a bunch of weird rationalizations why the thing's not working,
yep,
that's the best scenario. You write those down, and then you got to dig in and figure out what the heck is actually going on.
Ignore what they said.
Ignore their suggestions.
But focus on the feelings that they were having. You know,
I think the other nice thing about alphas in particular, the beta for Crash Lands was a relief in a lot of ways, because I think, you know, we've been working on the game again for, I think it was like it was 8 months or even a year from the alpha.
Over a year.
Yep.
And that was also, we were trying to figure out when launch is going to happen, all this stuff. And so it was a relief because it was working in the sense that, you know, we had people playing it for like 100 hours, which is ridiculous. So, you know, at that point that people aren't just being nice to you about something.
Right.
Which is good.
People play something for 10 minutes sort of as a gesture.
Right.
You know.
Right.
So nobody's going to dump 100 hours into your game.
Besides just having the on the technical side, like the feedback, or even on the design side, the feedback, there's actually a good morale boost. I think that it's almost always come from doing play tests where it's really fun, even if it turns out that the thing is just not hitting the marks.
It's an ego check and a morale boost simultaneously.
Yes, and sometimes they are the same, which is kind of weird, but like it's because you get really excited because you're like, oh, we know why this sucks, which is a very different thing, different thing than just suddenly knowing that it sucks but not getting feedback about it. So I really enjoy them. I think we need to do one probably sometime soon.
Yeah. So I think in terms of our general philosophy, just the way that we approach this stuff is I don't really know what sort of the standard would be for what's an alpha and what's a beta or whatever.
Beta means feature complete,
but not content complete.
But not necessarily content complete.
Okay.
We use beta as feature and content complete with the assumption that there are lots of bugs that need to be resolved
or a few holes.
Right. And for us, we use alpha to mean either feature complete but not content complete, or aspects of the game are feature complete and we want to test those aspects.
Right.
And so, but different people do mean different things. And so you need to be careful kind of what you mean.
Yeah. I mean, the first alpha for Crashlands didn't have, that was before the story was in.
There's only one biome.
One biome. Story.
We had all the systems in, but I think they ended up changing quite a bit by the time they hit.
A few of them did.
Yeah.
No boss fights.
Right. It was at 30 frames per second instead of 60.
Yep.
Just smooth. So smooth.
What we did leading up to the alpha was after our first 6 months of development, we started inviting people to play the game in, Sam's apartment.
Yeah.
Or my apartment, whatever.
It was luxurious. We want to get them in a luxurious state of mind.
Yeah. So we would just, hand them a device, slap them down on the couch, and then
slapped them.
And they would just play the game. And then like Sam and I would each be perched on one arm of the couch, basically, and just kind of lurking behind them.
Very luxurious.
And just kind of, and we just had notepads. We never said a word and we just watched what they did and just took notes. And sometimes they would narrate their experiences or whatever, but usually they would just play and we would just watch. And so, we had some people who would play and they would get so pissed off or frustrated because of some broken thing. They would try to throw themselves against it for like 10 minutes and they'd just be like, you know what? I just don't.
Not worth it.
This is not worth it. You know, right. We'd be like, it's fair. It's a fair point.
Yeah. I mean, I think the first one of those we did, we had over 200 sort of line items come out of our, that was 30 minutes of playtesting.
Yeah. We're just furiously scribbling all the things that are wrong with the game.
Everything's broken.
And so really for us, you know, the early stage of the game is to get it into a point where we have at least some sense of a tutorial or some way to show the player how to play. And that the core concept of the game is to a point where it's realized enough that somebody could play it and we can start to ask really hard questions about what works with that and what doesn't.
Yeah, because things in a game are so interdependent that you can't get meaningful feedback until all those interdependent parts, as you think that you want them to be, are actually in place.
Right.
Because if you're missing anything and then you get feedback, then that feedback might become irrelevant the moment you actually add that thing.
Yeah.
And so there's a certain degree of kind of feature completeness that is required for you to get meaningful feedback from anybody.
Yeah, we definitely felt that with Crashlands in particular. We had a few of the points from the alpha where people were like, I enjoy the gameplay, but I don't know why I'm playing. Like, it feels kind of pointless.
Right.
And, you know, we could make a bunch of changes to various systems to try to do that, but the reality was it was missing the story, which was the thing that actually gave you, it was genuinely pointless. And so it's one of those things where, you know, if we tried to solve that problem by fixing all the other systems to like orient them toward that, then it probably would have broken the whole game versus saying, okay, we have a systems hole here. Let's put, you know, some narrative in there.
Yeah.
So it's something you have to do.
Yeah,
you have to get feedback from people. You have to test the game.
I think, you know, and especially even if you're a really small team, you know, we would do this thing, like with Quadrupus, we enlisted at least a dozen or so people who were not even people in St. Louis per se, but people across who were reporters for different websites and stuff to give the game an early playthrough and check out and to give us any feedback weeks before we were going to launch. Part of the idea there was that these people probably know what they're looking for more than we do and probably are better at putting it into words. So we sort of just picked those ones. And that's where, you know, having the boss fight in Quadrupus Rampage came from. So
yeah, even if you're super Pete small. And Quadrupus Rampage was added 2 weeks before launch, which is the whole story of the game, right?
But again, the feedback was, this game is fun, but it's pointless, which maybe
which apparently we have a tendency to make pointless yet fun games.
So you absolutely have to do it. Even if it's just, you know, a few friends, even if it's like a dozen people, you just do something because it'll add so much power to the game overall that it's kind of ridiculous.
Just remember, don't do it too early and make sure you know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise,
it's especially frustrating if you show it to someone, you're like, all right, so here's the deal. I know these systems are broken. I know the art in this particular area is garbage.
Yep.
Don't worry about those things. And then they just get like hung up on something.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing is like,
shut up.
Yeah. If that's the case though, then don't show it.
Yeah.
Right. Like if you have to hedge it in all these different ways, there's another thing that people do when they show people their games, which drives me insane, which is they tell people how they should feel about things. Mm-hmm. So they'll hand somebody a game and they'll be like, here comes the good part. Oh, so it's going to be so cool. And it's like, no.
Kind of like watching a YouTube video with a friend, you know?
Yeah,
like
when
they
want to
show you one. It's like, just let it speak. Let it do its thing.
It's like, no, you don't get to tell the player how they're going to feel about the game. That's the game's job, right? And so just don't.
Yeah, if you find yourself wanting to say anything when you're doing an alpha or a beta or showing your game at all, if you find yourself wanting to say something, then you've failed.
Mm-hmm. And write that down because that's something you got to fix.
Yeah, you got to fix that.
Yeah.
That's one of the bugs in your...
We tend to let people struggle for at least like 3 to 5 minutes on a particular thing before we're like, okay, you just hit this button to fix it.
Because, then we write that down.
Yeah, then we're like, okay, I got to fix that.
Because we also want to see what people try. Like what kinds of things are they going to do or what do they expect to happen? Because the way that people struggle to solve problems when you haven't done a good job of explaining things is actually very informative as to what kinds of solutions people are going to look for.
Yeah. It reveals people's expectations.
Yeah. All right. So let's go on to the next question. It's from Angry Muffin, who says, in episode 84, you talked about how difficult it is to name and categorize your games. Have you thought about how to describe Scuffle Buddies yet? Or is it still too early?
I've been thinking about it a lot. Pretty sure I know how to, but I'm not talking about it yet, just in case it's a bad idea. So,
well, I want to talk about the problem of categories just in general and what it means to be in a category. Yeah.
I'm a firm believer that if you have no category at all, you're better off than having any particular category.
Because you're creating a category.
Yeah.
I'm dubious about that.
I know. This is an argument we have constantly. Yeah. But it's good. Like, it's good to have that.
Those two sides.
It's good to have those two sides. Well,
so the idea behind categories is that people have only a certain amount of shelf space in their brains to hold certain things of certain categories. So if I said to somebody, you know, hey, name 5 crafting games, they'd be like Minecraft, maybe Terraria, maybe Don't Starve, maybe Crashlands, probably not though, right?
We're far down that list.
And anything beyond that is going to be essentially random from person to person. But there's always going to be a few games that are just there on everybody's list in that category. And
isn't true of like an RPG. Who's going to have the same items in that list?
True. But if you said...
specify a little more though.
Right. If you said like a JRPG or
like a 3D open world RPG.
Right. So this is the point here is...
Still not the same one, though, because there are a jillion of those.
But Skyrim's going to be on there.
Skyrim, The Witcher, and Fallout.
Right. Yeah. And so...
If somebody even really thinks about those as RPGs.
Right. So the important point here is figuring out, when you talk about your game, how do you create a perception that it's that it's in a different category, even if it isn't. So I think about, say, like No Man's Sky, which, again, we always come back to as an interesting marketing example, because they just made a crafting game. They made a procedural crafting game, right? But by doing the whole, like, universe exploration thing, they sidestepped the idea that this is just Minecraft in space, right? And all they talked about was just how big it was, and they focused on the universe, not the crafting. And I didn't even know that there was crafting until after the game came out, because they never really talked about that fact.
So it sort of slipped into this category of
adventure,
open mostly. Universe,
open universe RPG, adventure, right. RPG or right. something. Yeah. And so I think the difficulty that we had when we were marketing Crashlands was we kept bumping into sort of there's this ceiling in the crafting category, and even in survival, right? Mm-hmm. Which people kept calling Crashlands a survival game. We never called it that. That's something
it's
that
because crafting and survival tend to actually go together.
Right.
Most games plunk them together.
Right. And so there are these sort of these dominant players already in these categories who just have sort of, you know, they've accumulated all the players.
Sort of sucked all the oxygen out of that particular container, if
right.
you will.
And so we couldn't get as much traction as we needed to. So when it comes to Scuffle Buddies, you know, we can't yet talk about what category we will put it in, but we're going to try to find a way to sidestep people's preconceived notions about what kind of a game this might be or right. what its competitors are. Because the fact is, it actually is going to be incredibly different than anything people have seen.
Yeah.
The challenge is going to be convincing people that that's the case.
Well, so right? yeah, but the other challenge, which is the idea of where categories are very useful, is because you need something when you're marketing a game or you're marketing any idea, there's the combination of both familiarity and surprise that you want to have. You want to have both of those things put together. Because if something's completely outside the realm of what someone's thought about, then it tends to be much harder to simulate whether or not you'd enjoy it, right?
Yeah.
So if you said, okay, you know, here's a sports car that, you know, goes 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. You're like, cool, I have an idea of a sports car, neat. If I was like, here's a sport wagon that has a rocket booster on the back of it. Also, it goes over waves like it's a boat. Actually,
it's a
wagon boat. Are you in the market for a wagon boat? I haven't really thought about it.
It does sound interesting.
It does sound pretty dope. But your ability to simulate like if you would enjoy it kind of gets hampered by the lack of an actual categorical understanding of that thing.
Yeah.
So my whole argument, though, is that genres as categorization tools don't actually provide information.
They're weak.
Yeah. Which means that the best that they can do is make somebody have the wrong idea about your product.
Well, there's another interesting part about genres for games. So if you think about genres for movies, so we saw Thor this weekend, or Sam and I did. Adam,
He didn't make it. My wife is still catching up on the MCU, so I'm waiting until she gets there, and then I will be watching.
To be fair, I thought I was caught up, and then they were talking about a bunch of stuff, and I was like, I have no idea what they're talking about.
Well, so,
I am otherwise caught up, though.
Yeah, they did a really good job in Thor of just sort of allowing you to start. I think they acknowledged that the previous two Thor movies are kind of bad, so they just kind of, they're like, let's start fresh. And they just made a couple references back to them, but to the point of like dismissively almost. So that was good. But I think there's an interesting thing that Thor did. And I think Guardians of the Galaxy is doing as well, which is previously people would just be like superhero movie. It's a superhero movie. What you do is you got a character with superpowers and there's a villain and they punch the shit out of each other in the end credits, right? With the modern superhero, like there have been so many superhero movies that people are starting to go,
you're fatigued.
People are like, what can we do with this? So now, like the new Thor movie, it's a superhero comedy.
Right.
Like it's not just like an action movie.
And actually, most of them are trending in that direction too, right? Guardians of the Galaxy kind of started that. Iron Man was sort of the original where it was actually very funny.
Yeah. Well, think about like Logan. Like it's a really serious drama that's really, really sad.
Yeah.
But it's a superhero movie.
Right.
Or Jessica Jones.
Right. Which is like it's a
real gritty kind of crime.
Like a noir.
It's like a Private Eye.
Yeah. Show. Where she just happens to also have a superpower that they underplay the shit out of.
Right.
Yeah.
Because it's not about that.
Right. Cause she's real strong, but she also is very breakable. You know? So like she'll have a broken rib. you know, one episode, and like the next two episodes, she's just like, fuck, ow, my rib, which is not something that happens to superheroes normally.
But there are, but I mean, like, if you were to take that as an example, there's some sort of horror elements, there's some sort of romance elements, there's some, because of course it's not, you can't just encapsulate the thing as a superhero movie. Yeah. Or as a noir or whatever. Well, and if you did, I don't believe that that's good. I just don't believe.
The thing is, I don't quite agree, because I think it's really easy for people to get understanding. So if I said, so for example, like you start with the initial genre, which is the superhero genre, right? Started a couple, like, decades ago.
I don't like superhero movies.
Well, maybe you do.
No, I'm not listening anymore.
Right. That's totally possible.
Yeah, it's a problem.
But I think that's where you start. If you start piling these things together, then you say, oh, it's a superhero noir movie. Like, that sounds interesting. Or a superhero romance flick.
Don't like romance.
Or if you hate noir movies.
Well, that's an interesting point, because there was a marketing guy who was talking about the problem of this, because as you add genres to your sort of theoretical list of how you describe your game, the Venn diagram, like, people
get smaller.
People require that they have both of the genres or all three of the genres before they're like, this sounds like a thing I'd be interested in. So if I said, hey, this is an action comedy romance game, you're like,
ooh, romance.
Well, romance I don't like. Action comedy I'm all about.
Or if you're like, ooh, game.
Or you're like, it's an action comedy horror. Like, I wouldn't play that, even though I'd probably actually enjoy the shit out of it, right? So it's like, there's that interesting point, which is you don't want to stack too many Venn diagram rings together, because otherwise you end up with a really small.
Well, because people have decided that they hate stuff, right?
That is because, both true and weird.
Yeah, yes. And I have presumably sort of a, you know, sociocultural product, which is that I'd have no interest in romance as a genre, right? Mm-hmm. But it's actually, as I've talked about with my wife, it's because I grew up thinking it was a bad thing because everybody told me that it was. And so I actually don't know. I knew literally nothing about it. It was just a thing I hated. Right.
Right.
Which is usually
how people hate things.
People hate.
Exactly. And so if you were to think about any one genre that you supposedly hate, how many of the things have you actually seen in that genre? I'd peg it near zero, right?
Horror movies I'm good on. Saw enough of this.
Like, yeah, but a lot of them are actually comedies, you know, and like, but there are certain things, obviously, that once you have seen or even just know the content of, you could know that you're going to hate, like, say, torture movies or something, right? That's unambiguously fucked up. And if you're into that kind of thing, questionable.
Just don't.
But so this is the thing that bugs me about genres, is that they convey no information.
And they give people things to hate.
But they give people things to hate.
But I guess this thing is like, the question is the problem with the genre or with everybody else?
No, it's with everybody else. But that's the problem is that's who we're selling games to.
So, is everybody?
It's people.
Damn it.
Yeah. I always think about this from my own perspective, because especially my sort of gaming background was never ever focused on genre as a thing. I liked certain kinds of play styles. So I liked first person shooters, right? That's kind of how I like to play games. But I don't like, you know, like Battlefield and these like really big military kinds of games. I prefer like Half-Life and that sort of stuff. So I kind of, for me, it was always this vibe I was looking for, where the sort of like you're playing as the main character, where you're kind of like fighting stuff in this first person view. And it's kind of this fast twitch kind of a game. But I played horror games. So I was playing like the fear games. You know, I played more comedic ones like, what do we call it? Portal, right? Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And TF2 and like all these other kinds of things. So I played a lot of those kinds of things because I liked that general play style, but wasn't ever paying attention or looking for the genre. Mm. Right. And for me, like because I had those sort of grown, like sort of embedded feelings of dislike or disinterest in certain kinds of categories, so take like RPGs. Mm-hmm. RPGs to me, the first RPGs I played were boring as fuck. And I did not like them at all. Right. And the thing,
remember
that
which ones
them,
they were?
I don't remember which ones they were.
They're so boring. Just deleted.
But back when I was, you know, in like high school, probably, right? My perception of an RPG is it's set in medieval times. Mm-hmm. It has infinite text that I have to read.
Definitely,
there's
elves.
A lot of inventory management. There's elves and orcs, and like it's tropey as all hell, mm-hmm. right? And to me, when I hear RPG, I think of my first RPG experience.
Right.
When I hear sci-fi. Now I've read so much sci-fi that if I hear the word sci-fi, now it has become meaningless, actually, right? But certain things like RPG, to me, do carry a meaning, and it's not a good one. Mm. Even though RPG doesn't mean shit, right?
Right.
All of these genres are actually just as meaningless as each other. But for some people, certain genres have a lot of meaning. And my bet is that when it does, the more meaning it has, the more likely it is that they don't like it.
What do you mean?
As in, like, if RPG means something specific to you, it's either because you love a very specific kind of RPG or you hate all of them.
Or you've only played one or two
right. That
maybe weren't the best examples.
Right. Yeah, because who says they love RPGs and they play both, like, Banner Saga and Fallout 3 and love them to the same degree and thinks of them both as RPGs in the same sense?
Right. Well, I think, but this is an interesting point because, like, the question basically becomes, how do you actually talk about a game? Because the truth is, like, you do need to describe it. There's no, you have to describe it so people can understand it.
I think you do.
Well, no, you don't.
I think you do. What do you mean you do?
Should we talk about our A-B test that we did?
Yeah, sure. Yeah,
that's fair.
All right, here's the thing. Listen,
so
on Google Play, you can do A-B tests.
And we've been fooling around.
And we thought, we can do A-B tests. Let's really do some A-B tests.
Let's do something weird.
So we did an A-B test where we literally deleted the description of Crashlands.
Took it all out.
So half of people who saw our store page saw a description, and the other half just saw a couple of quotes from
the credibility things.
Yeah, so like Touch Arcade, like Game of the Year or whatever, literally no other information. Mm-hmm. So, you know, normally we have like a feature list. We describe what the game is. Guess what? They performed essentially identically.
Which is kind of upsetting.
Also, for a while, the little tagline, because that's another thing you can control, right? Actually referred to, you know, it was like a crafting adventure RPG or whatever. And so I deleted RPG because, like, that's the thing in my brain means bad, right? And I was like, this must mean bad to other people too. So I just took that out of there. And again, no statistical change.
Right.
Which definitely means that people aren't using that as a reason to buy things.
But they're also not using it at all.
They're not using it at all. Right.
Right.
And because it doesn't mean anything.
So what we're learning is maybe what you say about the game just doesn't fucking matter.
Maybe.
At all.
You just gotta show stuff. Yeah.
You gotta show what the game is.
Yep. But like, it's also where the power of the art, and then like usually the one particular angle, because you have to take an angle verbally to be able to talk about it, right? You have to take one, whether it's like the store bilingual. All the stores require a ton of text, so you can't get away with literally not putting anything in there. Because the reason why we left that block of those credibility building statements in there was because we had to have text in there.
We couldn't just have
you can't have a blank store.
They don't allow you to have nothing.
So you do, and then of course you get to pick genres to put it in. Categorically on the storefronts. So the question is, like, would you put Crashlands first into the RPG category or into the adventure category?
Yeah. And then that impacts what puzzle your rankings.
And I think importantly, what the fuck do adventure and role-playing game mean? Because
you're usually going on an adventure.
Because Minecraft is in one and then Terraria is in another. If you like look at how games are put into genres there, they're actually... It's basically random.
Yeah, but like if you go into the role playing game section of say Google Play, it ranges from like Final Fantasy to Crashlands to like you're a hairstylist at a salon.
Right. Yeah. Because those are all role playing.
Those are all role playing games, and that is a completely fair label for literally any of those. Just as it's a fair label for every game.
Right. So why use that as a category? Well, and same with adventure. Right. The whole idea, like a fucking match three puzzle game, is an adventure.
It can be.
You're going on a roller coaster ride of emotions.
You're like, am I going to match it? No? Okay. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I mean, the interesting thing is that when you start blending the genres, though, is usually where the fun mechanics come out. So I think of You Must Build a Boat, for example, for just a phenomenal version of this, where it is a match game. It's a matching puzzle game, but it's actually this RPG adventure. I'm using all those words at the same time, and that Venn diagram overlaps like really effectively in this particular case as far as describing what that is.
Yeah, but I think that's but it only does once you've played. Right,
but on the store, you got to pick one.
Oh, yeah.
You
got to
put a category. Yeah, yeah. Which one is it?
But also, I don't think it serves well as a selling point. I think it serves well to describe the game once you've played it, right? Because if you play You Must Build a Boat, and you're trying to figure out how do I compare this to the other things that I've played in a way that kind of makes them make sense. And then that's really, it's a literal mashup of a few other game types, right? And you can easily do that. But if you were to tell me, like, hey, there's this awesome game you should go play. It's an RPG adventure match three.
Let's talk about this real quick.
No, thank you.
A game we mentioned a few weeks ago, just to sort of test this idea, because Kit Fox's Boyfriend Dungeon, right?
Yeah. Well, you didn't tell me anything about the genre, though. You just told me what happens in the game and what I'm going to experience.
It's a dungeon crawling romance game.
I don't care about that. What I cared about was when you said, you go in, you find weapons.
And then you date them.
That was what I needed to hear. I need to hear that little tagline.
Sure.
Like, because if the tagline of that game, so it's like boyfriend dungeon, and then the tagline is date your weapons, you know? Like, I would look into that. Mm-hmm. That's intriguing.
It's weird.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, well, this goes into an interesting point because there's a part of marketing which is about specificity. And the idea here is that the more specific that you can get about what a thing actually does, oftentimes the more someone actually feels like they might understand what it is. And that's kind of what you're getting
at. But does that make them more likely to want it?
No. I think in the case of boyfriend dungeon, does it close
other people out too, is their question.
Well, so we're talking about different things. So I'm arguing your point, which is that saying this is an RPG or saying this is an adventure is actually not, as you're saying, describing it.
Right.
And so if instead you can pick, you just pick a very specific thing about it. So in Catalfight's case, it was shoot animals out of your face. If you like that byline, you're going to like the game.
Yep.
You're going to have a good time. In the boyfriend dungeon case, date your weapons. Yeah. Weird. Okay. Right. Yeah. I'm into it. I'll watch the trailer and check it out. So
you fire up Talfight. You are now shooting animals out of your face and you're like, this is what I signed up for.
But I think that's an interesting point is that what you're getting at is essentially that the genres are, it kind of goes back to this curse of knowledge thing, right? Like you think, there's actually a really funny study that was mentioned in the Made to Stick thing, which is called the Tappers and Listeners study, where they would task, say, Seth, you with tapping out the Star Spangled Banner or something. And then the other person has to listen and try to guess what the song is.
Ah.
And 75% of the time, the person tapping it out thinks that the other person should know it. Like oh yeah, they're going to get it for sure.
Right.
It's like 2% of the time does the other person actually get it, right? So this idea of this curse of knowledge thing.
Yeah,
I wonder how much of this has to do actually with picking genres too. Because it's like, you know what you mean because you've been playing the shit of this game it's an adventure.
It's
you
an
know,
action crafting RPG is what
makes
we
perfect
say
sense.
About
and it
Crashlands.
Does. Like when I'm thinking about Crashlands, it makes perfect sense.
And if you've played Crashlands, it will also make perfect sense.
But if you haven't,
then
which is the one
is
person,
which is the only person
need,
that matters.
We need to convey the information.
So
to.
I think that's probably a good point. Which is just going back to the question, picking actually a specific way to talk about it, a very specific thing that you do in the game, even if that ends up being a part of the genre. Like, I think that's the point where it's okay.
Yep.
Because, for example, if you're like, date your weapons, like, dating is, that's a romance mechanic, right? People know what that means.
I don't really know what that means.
I don't know how honestly, to date either, but, you know, like, that's the thing. But, so
that's what makes me curious about
it. Yeah, but, like, in a video game, I think people often ask questions like, how come, like, relationships and stuff in video games are so one-dimensional, whereas the violence in games is so, like, wide-ranging, right? I think it's because stabbing something is a real simple move.
It's actually one dimensional.
Right. You just go and you just like put a knife in a thing.
And the question is just, am I stabbing or not?
Am I stabbing? Not. It's a true false statement, right? But if you want to date somebody, that's real complicated. There's a lot of factors that go into dating.
Yeah.
But stab.
unless you just ask, are we dating or not?
True false.
True false. Then that's a pretty good one.
Why do you think
that's kind of how it worked in eighth grade?
This kind of goes back to the actual core of it then is just pick a really specific descriptor of the thing. I think about this, there's a downhill racing game that came out or is announced came out recently. And the guy wrote an article on games industry about how to talk about marketing these things. And he had this idea, there's a differentiation between the hook and the kicker and how people get them confused. So in his case, they made a very true to life sort of a downhill mountain biking game. Which is awesome because that doesn't exist. So people know what that is. Again, it's not just a genre. He wasn't just like, it's a sports game. It's a downhill mountain biking game. And then the kicker, so that's the hook, the kicker procedurally generated. Mm-hmm. So every time you go flying down this mountain, like it's a different thing, it's fun. But that's also like, he's leaning on a very specific thing.
But he's also saying that it being procedurally generated cannot be a hook.
Correct.
Because
so many games have that.
Yeah.
But I think that's the point is that if you were to describe it, say, as a sports game or just a biking game,
right,
then you're not getting the point across. And maybe that's what it is.
And I wouldn't care about a biking game, but if you describe it as like, I get to bike downhill and I'm thinking about avoiding obstacles and stuff. Because if you just call it a biking game, I'd be like, what? So I'm like, I'm doing like
pedaling.
Yeah, right. What the fuck?
Delivering newspapers.
Right. Yeah. Though if it was a newspaper delivery game, that might be interesting.
Slash obstacle course.
Yeah.
Right. I think be specific and try to find a thing. This is what we talked about last week, which is find a thing that you can talk about that people just naturally get excited about with
it. I think this is where Crashlands has been our marketing bane of existence, correct, which is that it has a whole bunch of fun stuff in it, but there's not a thing that we or anybody else has pointed to that says like, that just sort of in some way encapsulates it. Mm-hmm. You know, there's no.
Well, I even remember the, so we had, when we did got into PAX 10, Tycho, one of the guy from Penny Arcade, so he played it and he wrote up a little blurb about it. And it was just like, it was essentially the same problem we had been having, which he's
like, he was like, I can't describe this game because it has everything.
Yeah. He's like, it seemed like they had so much fun making this game that they couldn't stop like adding cool stuff to it. And that was it. Like he couldn't.
Yeah. Which can be okay then. Like that can totally be okay. But if all we had, like if it was the case that, like the, so Flux only interacts with things by slapping them, mm-hmm. you know? So.
Which kind of is a good way to boil down that game.
Yeah, you know? It's just, you just slap stuff, right? So if we could find a way to take something like that and just make a tight little message.
Slap
that's
the world.
Actually, yeah, like slap the world, right?
Yeah.
You know, maybe we can make that intriguing again. Like we talked about, I think it was last week about that Death Road to Canada, which again, mm-hmm. you could describe that game in
zombie
its entirety.
Apocalypse game.
Sounds completely uninteresting. Until you pull in the line.
It has dogs that drive cars.
now I'm on board, right?
Intrigued. And I think is that the hook or is that the kicker?
So I think it's both in that case.
Yeah. That was just good.
Yeah.
But I think that's the thing is like, Crashlands was designed just to be a great gameplay experience.
Well, you could also mix it overall. Too. So in the case of Death Road to Canada, it's like you could say this is a post-apocalyptic party-based RPG where you have dogs that can drive your car. Now it's like, yeah. bah! Like I got to say, though, specific.
You actually lost me, though.
Maybe
one.
I did.
Because I got so bored with all the... Because
the hook isn't that it's a zombie.
It's the dog can drive your car.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, yeah. Like, yeah, because you basically like, you're like, you basically said... This is a terrible tropey game that mm-hmm. also has dogs in it.
It's a good idea. It's good. Yeah. So this references the idea of not burying your lead.
Yeah.
Right? So in
if
headlines
it bleeds,
case,
it leads.
Well, in headlines case, it's like, don't give me all the backstory about what happened. Tell me what happened first and then give me the backstory.
Yeah.
You're going to pull a what, Tarantino.
Yeah, Tarantino it.
Tarantino everything you do. You just like, dogs drive cars in this game. Also, it's a party-based RPG. Because that's yes. a further detail.
Have your dog, if it was like, have your dog drive you through the apocalypse or yeah. something, you're like, yes!
Yeah,
sign me up. So, all right, let's get on to...
Hey, we should maybe try some taglines on with our Google Play A-B testing with Crashlands, just weird ones.
I'm down.
Slap the world.
I mean, the fact is, we could probably delete them entirely and it wouldn't matter.
Yeah.
It might not. We should actually have one that's blank.
Just replace it with a single space character.
Or just a smiley face.
Or that one really, really long face with like a dot on one end and underscore and a dot. So you pull it up, it's just this face looking
at you. All right, so let's get on to next question, which is from Woland77. And I don't know if we have an answer for this one. So
hit me.
Woland77 says... You talk a lot about passions and chasing yours. Do you have any advice for people who have not found their passions?
I just want to clarify that I don't have one.
Also me.
Yeah, we don't actually, I think a lot of people interpret what we talk about that way, but yeah. we don't actually really talk about passion a lot.
Mm-hmm. I was always very confused and annoyed in college because that's what everyone's always talking about. And you go to these career seminars where you're like, I'm trying to figure out what I'm trying to do. And they're like, just find your passion. And I was like, do I not have this? Is this not a thing I have? And what I realized is mine is a general diffuse version. I don't have even games. Like I don't have a particular thing where I'm just like, I love this so much that this is just what I'm all about. It's actually the doing and the process oriented around the doing that I really, really enjoy. That's sort of where the nebulous passion lies, which no one talks about that being a possibility. That you can just love executing or that you can love like process orientation.
Yeah. Well, I think the framing that people tend to use with passion is they pick a thing, right. Playing piano,
as opposed to a way.
Whatever. Yeah, as opposed to just kind of a way of living. So there's a book by the astronaut Scott Kelly. It's called Endurance. I just started reading it, but he was the astronaut who spent over a year in the International Space Station. And at the outset, I started reading this book and I was just like, wow, this is very telling because apparently. He was a terrible student, like straight Fs, because he didn't give a shit about sitting in a desk and reading. All he ever wanted to do was go outside and like crash things and like ride bikes really fast and jump off of stuff and like crawl through things he wasn't supposed to go into. and of course, he was a problem student, right? Nobody wanted him around. The teachers just ignored him because he never gave a shit. And it turned out that where other people would see that and they'd be like, well, he doesn't care. Like he doesn't have a passion for anything. And it's like, no, he just likes to go take risks.
Right. Like he has a passion for risk taking.
Right. Which right. Like concept. That's not, yeah. So it's like, it's more of a concept. It's more of just like a way of living. Right. And it's not about playing the piano or something like that. It's just whatever he could do that kind of tapped into that thing that he liked.
And the beauty of having a passion for a way of approaching the world just in general is that now you can go do almost anything.
Yeah.
And as long as you're still keeping the part of the, you know, still focusing on that part that you really care about, then now you can do anything. You're not restricted to being in one industry or in any particular domain. You can be a guy who loves almost dying while riding a bike and then become an astronaut as a consequence.
Right. Cause they're actually very closely related. Same thing.
Yeah.
And I think,
presumably he also loved to work really hard though. Cause that's another requirement for,
he didn't though. I mean, it's not about loving working hard. It's about just feeling like the thing you're doing is interesting and fun.
Right. Yeah. We've talked about this before about the misattribution onto discipline as being the important thing when it's like, you need to find the way to do things that doesn't require that you're so
that
disciplined.
You're battling it all the time.
Or that you're working, they're quote unquote working hard. Cause like we put in a ridiculous amount of work here, both in terms of focus. Like whenever anybody comes to visit, they're like, what? It's just silent. People are just crunching.
You just
away.
Hear keyboard clacks.
Yeah. But then everybody gets up at 4 and like goes to the gym and leaves. Right.
Yep.
And maybe reads at home, does some work at home, but like the feeling of it is not, it doesn't feel like it's hard work.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. And I think it's because of the way that it's approached.
Well, somebody asked me last week what I would do if I wasn't making games.
Mm.
And I was like, you know, it doesn't really matter. Like, whatever I did, it would be really interesting to me.
Like, right. Like, it doesn't matter to you.
Yeah, like, it wouldn't matter. And this is something that drives me crazy. So many people I talk to and I ask them about, you know, what they're doing on the day-to-day, and they don't want to talk about it. They're just like, oh, like I manage accounts for, you know, this shipping company and we, you know, we route things across the country. And I'm like, holy shit, that is fucking awesome. Like what's that like, you know?
Yeah.
How do
goods get to people?
How do you do that? Like, I don't know how anything goes anywhere. Mm-hmm. Right. And this has to be a really interesting set of problems to solve. Right. And so I think anything you do can be interesting if you just approach it from that angle.
My best buddies used to work at Shell and they had a guy who was retiring. And this guy was he became the dude who was the one who simulates flow through pipes.
He's the pipeman.
And he's like the one person, one of the few people in the world who just like did this for 40 years or something. And he gave this presentation before he left, though, sort of like, here's a bunch of the knowledge about how this works just for you guys. And my friend said it was the most mind blowing thing because it's just pipes. Like it's just stuff going through pipes. But
how hard could it be?
But hydrodynamics is really
good. Hydrodynamics is really hard. And then on top of that, like the level of complexity that like this guy approached to work with was just incredible. Where you could see if he had made applied to say how a refinery works or how a social media campaign is run. I mean, that dude would have just he would be quote unquote the pipe guy anywhere. Like he's that sort of person, right?
Yeah. So again, it's not about this guy growing up wasn't like my passion is figuring out how liquid flows through tubes. That's my thing. I'm going to do that for 40 years. He just had a way of approaching this kind of a thing that allowed him to just be really fucking pumped about it and always find new and interesting ways to think about it. Right. And so I think that would be the way to start thinking about it.
Mm-hmm. Or at least that's where I've gotten to with it because I didn't ever have one. So, you know, you have to want to be alive for some reason. So I think either it's for a particular thing, which I do think is fine. If you're just like, I'm all about piano, cool, enjoy yourself. But if you don't necessarily have one, don't worry about it. Because if you can create and then fall in love with the way of doing things or a particular way of living, then you're
and you can do anything.
Yeah.
You can crash bikes all day and
go be an astronaut.
Technically you can get paid for that. Actually, you got to sometimes not crash though, I think in order to actually be a professional, next question comes from T Juice. I'm not sure what
is it T or is it juice?
It's the letter T and then juice.
I think it's just T.
Could be tangerine. It might just be tea. It's just tea.
Tea juice is just tea.
Hello, B-Scotch Bros. What is your recommendation for getting into PC and web programming? Is college a good route to get started towards game dev while still being able to snatch a job in an effort to provide for your family?
Or is getting a job part?
Or is self-taught better due to cost? So, well, before we hit this, I want to point out that this is a recommendation for PC and web programming and game dev.
Yeah.
Which is a lot. We're spreading too thin here.
Because game dev is not programming.
Right.
Game dev is
simulating
entire universes.
With your mind.
With your mind, converting that into programming.
Yeah. Programming is just the tool that you use to make the games.
Well, it's one of the tools.
It's one of the tools. But just being able to program doesn't mean you're going to be able to make games successfully.
Yeah.
There's other stuff.
Yeah. So the question is, when it comes to learning programming versus learning game development, the question is, do you want to have to learn everything or just programming? Right.
Yeah. Well, I think a better question too is which one gets better support from a formal education structure?
Yeah. Game dev does not.
From what we've seen.
Yes. Yeah. If you go into any kind of a formalized game development program in any school,
you walk away knowing nothing.
Yeah. Virtually guaranteed. And it's also the case that
there are some good ones. We shouldn't say like,
that's why I said virtually, I'd say,
but there are few enough that statistically speaking.
Yeah. But I think importantly, there's becoming a good game developer requires you to strive toward mastery over a huge number of disciplines, including psychology and storytelling, and you have to understand music to some degree and how that works.
It's kind of a lot.
Programming, all this stuff. And if you go to a game dev course in college, they're going to only focus on just the building parts, which is what we've seen so far, without pushing you toward the other things. And it also puts, from what we've seen of students in game dev courses, it puts them into a passive state where instead of aggressively going after this knowledge, they sit around and wait for somebody in there, for a professor to hand them the knowledge that they need, which is how people tend to approach school generally, but I think I don't think it's in your best interest to go into a game dev program.
Agreed.
Is that controversial?
I don't think so.
So, when it comes to actual programming, there have been times where I have wished that I had some kind of formalized training, but also knowing what I know now about what kind of training you actually get in college, I don't know if that actually would have been good.
I think the important thing, again, is actually to look at your approach, which is if you're using a course in any one of these disciplines, whether it's game dev, design, art, music, whatever. If you're using the courses as the sole basis for your education, then you're
wrong.
You're just like, you're going to not be good for making games. If you instead are using it as this sort of augment, because for example, you don't know how
Kickstart.
Yeah. You don't know how algorithms work. So you take an algorithms course. And then instead of just doing the work for your algorithms course, you're also say applying that to a game project you're working on at the same time. Now you're in the place where that knowledge becomes actually something very useful because you're using it more so as like a Kickstarter than the end all be all. I think that's basically what appears to be the mistake that a lot of people make with their college degrees is thinking just that,
period.
Yeah, really is just thinking that that is the knowledge when in reality, it's barely the basics for what you need to be doing in order to be really effective.
Yeah. Yeah. I would argue that in my experience, what I learned in college nowadays, looking back, feels like something like 1% of the knowledge that I now have, sort of in retrospect.
So, the thing is, it may have been the foundational
piece, I needed
right?
it.
Yeah. Right.
I needed it to get the other 99%. Right. But the point is, you can't just take the class and be like, there, I'm a game designer now. You got to still do all the work on your own to figure out
the nuance. I think this is why you can see the difference between, you can have two students who do 4 years of, for example, computer science or programming, whatever more technical angle in school, and they can have completely different skill sets at the end of it. Like one can be extremely good because they were actually sort of applying this to things as they were going and building things on the side and sort of exploring and using it as the basis. And then the other one could be sort of almost by paper.
Could have gotten straight A's, did great in all their classes.
Can't program the way out of a paper bag.
Yeah. Which is really hard to do.
Yeah. It's very difficult.
So the answer is you will get out what you put in from
no
literally
how you do it.
From literally everything. Taking college classes might be helpful unless you don't put in extra work.
If you're in the United States, though, it is very expensive.
Yes.
Yeah. So I would argue that there are very few circumstances where college is worth the cost nowadays, with the exception of things that require professional degrees, like being a lawyer or whatever, where you literally have to have
a stamp.
You have to have it in order to do the profession.
The question of whether that profession is worth it
That's a whole different question.
What's also a good thing to consider is that there's a lot of community college, especially near community colleges near really high ranked universities. A lot of the adjunct professors from that university, where they charge, say, like $6,000 per course, teach at the community college. So you just go get the same professor with the same curriculum and
for a few hundred bucks or whatever.
Right. Yeah. So there are ways around it.
You'd have to screen your stuff very carefully. I think the main problem actually with formalized education is that we just take whatever we're given as sort of the gospel truth of what we're supposed to know about that thing.
Right.
And especially if you don't take the extra step of learning more, then you are completely at the random whim of the professor that you have as to what you actually walk out with. And I think it's one of the major disservices that that kind of education just does in general, is that everybody walks away feeling like they actually
know something,
right? But all they know is what one person thought they should know. And not even that, what one person thought they would be capable of learning in that environment.
Right.
Because professors are not telling you everything that they know. They're not telling you everything that they want you to know. They're telling you what they think the average person in that class
can know
and actually like successfully complete a test with. Because professors aren't allowed to fail everybody in their class.
Well, there's also the idea of a different analogy between, say, describing how an atom works with the electrons that orbit around it. So if you're first learning about how this stuff works, usually apparently they use this again from the Made to Stick book. They use the analogy of the solar system. Because a lot of people have already learned about it.
Things are orbiting
around things. When in reality,
it's a probability cloud.
But what the fuck is that? Right. No one knows what that is.
There is no analogy.
But that's one of those things where like if all you get is that education up to that point, you have a fair understanding of it. Like,
yeah, cool. They're orbiting. Yeah.
They're around there. But in reality, it's not what's happening. And that's actually the thing I think it was shocking for me in college is that was not having the warning that that's where we were at for almost every single subject that I was in, which was, this is the basics. If you keep going, you will unlearn
the basics because they were all just there as a stand.
They're there to get you in.
For you to learn the real shit.
Yep.
And then what you thought was the real shit was also just the basics.
Yep.
And you don't get to learn any of that until you get way out on the limbs of that stuff. And so, but the other part of this question is the tricky one, which is it's about getting a job to support people.
Right. Because again, your professor doesn't care about that part either.
No, they do not.
They're not saying, how could I orchestrate a syllabus?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. But your employers don't have, they're going to assume that you don't know shit because that's a fair assumption. Right? But they're going to be trying to come up with a way to decide if I invest an enormous amount of resources, hiring you and training you and, you know, getting you up to speed, and then put my trust in you to be able to do the work and all this kind of stuff. If I do all of this, can you do it? Mm-hmm. Right. That's what an employer needs to know. And how are they going to tell if they're looking at what you provide? Because if you're self-taught, then you have maybe a portfolio. You'll have some way of trying to demonstrate it. If you went to university in some sort to learn that thing, then you can show your grades, your
GPA.
And so the question is, when it comes to the question of an employer, is what are they going to be looking at? And so what should you do as a consequence? And here, unfortunately, the answer is we can't provide an ethical answer to this question because we employ people ourselves, right? But we cannot speak on behalf of other employers. Mm-hmm. And I know certainly from being in the job market a long time ago and knowing lots of people who were in it, that employers are going to, there's no good way to evaluate people. There just isn't until you actually get them on board. And by that time, it's already very costly and too late. And so they're going to use just whatever, like, simplest
kind of
arbitrary metric they can come up with that's cheap, because they're trying to minimize the cost of bringing somebody on, given that they're probably actually not going to live up to what they need. And so they're going to look at your fucking grades. They're going to look at what school you went to, and they're going to use that as a cheap for them proxy for how good you're going to be.
But even then, it's sort of a coin toss as far as whether or not you have what they need and their environment is what you need. And
so if you don't, the problem here is that if you don't go to college for this thing, then you have to have some other way to demonstrate to people that you can do what they need you to do.
Mm-hmm.
And then that also in a lot of ways is going to change the kinds of companies you can work in. Although it actually goes in both ways, right? Cause like when we're looking at hiring people for our studio, we don't care about your college background. We don't care because we know how meaningless those things are.
So you're there.
So we don't care about that. So if you focused all of your time on that and didn't build a portfolio, for example, you'd have trouble getting a job with us.
Mm-hmm.
But if you focus your time building a portfolio and not going to college, you have a problem getting a job somewhere else.
So unfortunately, so you can't universally say, going to college makes it easier to get a job, because it depends.
Well, I think
where you're applying.
Getting a diploma with high grades and also having a portfolio seems like a good way to do it.
Yeah, that's their best case scenario.
But that's very costly. It's really hard, right?
Because now you got to dig your way out of that $100,000 hole that you just threw yourself into, or however much it was. Assuming you're lucky,
right?
That's 100, right. Maybe it's 300 or whatever.
Yeah.
So
it's a tricky problem.
So the short answer is.
The short answer is it will be much more cost effective if you have the discipline to learn yourself. And you'll actually learn a lot more given that same period of time, because you're not only learning what people are telling you, you're learning whatever you want as aggressively as you want. But that requires you to be in control of yourself.
Which most people are not. And that's fine. So if you need the structure of some courses, do that. But then also aggressively pursue your stuff.
And aggressively pursue how to get control of yourself.
Just be really aggressive.
Aggressive. Okay? But in a positive way. Mm-hmm. You know, mm-hmm. toward your own ambitions.
Yeah.
Not toward other folks.
No, not at
stuff
all.
Like that.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I think that's all the time we have. So we'd like to thank our studio wrangler, Monique, and our producer, Fat Bard, for putting this episode together. We'd like to thank the B-Scotch dev team for having our backs while we record this podcast. Special thanks to our community moderators who keep our Discord and forums running. And if you'd like to get more involved in the Butterscotch community, you can hop over to our Discord server, which is at discord.gg/B-Scotch. Come say hey. And if you'd like to adorn your bod with our dope-ass merch, you can head on over to shop.bscotch.net. Or if you'd like to send us some stuff to adorn our bods with, then you can send it to our mailbox, which you can find at mailbox.bscotch.net. Thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next week.
Bye.
Bye.